yesterday, George, was your exotic low noise amplifier a gallium arsenide field effect transistor? Was it a high electron mobility, a HEMT? Was it a gallium phosphide? Was it any of those exotic things that George got hit?
I'm trying to remember. I know the old, what is it, the MGF-1802, they're like, you know, 15 or 18 bucks a piece. And, you know, as much as it is, look at them and sneeze, they'll be destroyed. There's, it's a Toshiba number, I think. And, I think, is it RS parts? No, I think I even bought it from Mauser. 35 cents a piece, and they, at the frequency of interest that I'm looking at, between 900 and 1296, the noise figure of the device is like 0.3 dB. So, someplace I have the specs. If I can find it across the room here, I'll give you. It's a very, these enhanced mobility devices, and it's a GearSpec enhanced mobility device, which has some odd name.
Okay, and by the way, the most popular gallium arsenide field effect trend for low noise service is the MGF-1302, MGF-1402, and there's a slightly higher frequency version, MGF-1802 or 304 or whatever. All of those devices, you have to be careful with electrostatic discharge. In other words, that gate, if you walk across the room and scuff your feet on a wool rug, and then reach your finger over and touch the gate of that transistor, it's gone. It's history. So you got to keep those leads all shorted together before you get into your circuit, soldered down, and then remove the short circuit. You got to use very careful ESD practices when you're using these gas fed transistors. The actual junction inside is around micron in width. 0.07 micron is some of the really exotic ones that go up to the 100 to 150 gigahertz region. And so, in fact, some of the gas fed transistors that I have worked with four years ago that operated at 167 gigahertz was part of a radio telescope. It was part of a radio telescope measurement that was going into a very fancy satellite. If you picked up that transistor with tweezers and held onto the, and if you simply waved the transistor in the air, it would pick up enough static charge to wipe out its gate. Is that sensitive? And 0.07 microns means that the highest power optical telescope that you could put that transistor under, if you took off the cap and looked inside, you would not be able to resolve the gate. It was that small. So, boys, the good news is those transistors are super sensitive. The bad news is you got to be very careful with them, with electrostatic discharge, founding Project M. Okay, now the person that we've been skipping, I'm sorry to say, is poor old Bob, W2PNJ. I don't know how that happened, Bob. Please accept my apology, and I hope you're still there. W2 or WA2PNJ, K2IW with TechNet. You got it, Bob.
Relatively speaking, almost very inexpensive. So I bought five of them, figuring I can. So I want to turn over to the other fellow about the chat, the line 10 video line, and I wonder if that's how they were doing this kind of noise figure monitor that would be in the system all the time. So I didn't get his call, but I'll turn it back to you, Dick. You can turn it to him, K2RWWHVMP.
Very fine. Stand by a second, Bob. Yeah, the guy who was telling us about the inline measurement was Eric, KE2EJ, Kilo Echo 2 Echo Juliet, who just happens to be the chief engineer of Channel 21 and Channel 13 local PBS channel. So when it comes to video information, video broadcast information, he's the man you want to talk to. Eric, I was speculating that on some of your systems you might have a directional coupler in the receiver line with, let's say, a 20 dB directional coefficient, an automatic noise source, a bandpass filter that does it off to one side of where you're really doing your work, and then downrange after your amplifier, after your low noise amplifier, you've got a similar directional coupler and bandpass filter into your automatic noise figure indicator. So therefore, you could continuously be doing online automatic noise figure indication without disturbing the normal operation of the system. I'm speculating that you may have been doing something similar, and George would like to know a little bit more about what you're doing. If you're still there, Eric, KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, I did K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, we take a different approach. the concept is that we're producing a line that produces DC, and when everything is all equal, it's perfectly clean. It's sort of a, it's not the traditional type of noise measurement that you would consider, because we actually do the measurement after we've removed the carrier, and we look at the results of the modulated signal. And what we do is we keep a line that's perfectly blank. And when you actually look at that, that video or baseband, everything being done correctly will give you a noise figure that runs, oh, because this video, because you're taking a sample during a piece of the line, it has an absolute bottom noise floor of a perfectly generated signal. I think that's something around minus 100 dB or somewhere. It is a value. And they use a little bit of a logarithmic curve to compensate for the fact that you're demodulating it, and basically the receiver, which is hooked up to the transmitter, is a demodulator, and there is something called a zero carrier pulse, which is a reference signal, and we actually look at the DC component and measure noise off of that. So that's the way that they do that. It's not your traditional method of doing it. When you actually have a transmitter that's into a dummy mode, then you can put an actual noise signal in there and do it that way. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. My understanding now that you're time gating this thing, that during the vertical interval test signal period or something like that is when you could, if you wanted to, make this sampled noise power test. And I think you said you get a number like minus 100. And by the way, if it was a 1 megacycle referenced noise equivalent bandwidth, minus 100 dBm, would represent something close to a 0 dB noise figure. Back to you, Eric.
Exactly, that's correct. This is something that you can do continuously, because in the vertical blanking, you've actually got 11 lines in which to push stuff. And we actually put a lot of stuff. There's another method which they use, which actually puts a reference noise burst on a particular line in a test signal. And that's a different method. But traditionally, the way most broadcasters do it, or actually the way Tektronix came up with it, is we take a line which is essentially supposed to produce DC, and we do the measurement on that particular line. Go ahead.
Okay, that makes a little bit more sense. Thank you very much for stopping and giving us that further information. We got to get back to Bob. He was the second guy after Mel who signed in, and somehow forgotten about him. Mel and I are going to send you a ticket for you and your lady friend to a fancy restaurant to apologize for the delay. Mel's the guy with the big money, so he's gonna supply the ticket. W2PNJ to take it. K2RIW at the TechNet.
K2RIW, W2PNJ. Listen, I'll hold my breath, okay? If I have it.
You've got it. Please proceed.
Okay, good. Simple question. On my 100-watt transceiver, I have a feature where I can program my call sign or CQ, W2PNJ, and I'm able to monitor it on the built-in speaker. Now, when I plug my earphones in, I use a pair of Bose earphones, 30 ohm impedance stereo speakers, which the unit recommends to use as stereo headphones. It's perfectly clear on the earphones at 20 meters, but as I go up in frequency from 20, 17, 15, 10, I hear audio distortion on my earphones, only on the earphones. I pull the earphones out, there is no distortion, and the quality of the audio from people who receive my signal say is perfectly clear. I just wonder what's going on.
Colin, good question. What model number is that radio, that transceiver that you're using, Bob? I don't think you mentioned that one to us. You told us it's 100 watts, and go right ahead.
Okay, it's an Orion 2.
Okay, it's an Orion 2. Why should it do that? Why only with earphones? Distorted on the higher, on the, I think you said it's great on 20 meters. As you go toward 10 meters, it becomes distorted. Your Bose stereo headset, it wouldn't happen to be the Bose stereo noise-canceling headset, which I'm looking at right now. As you know, that's got a very fancy electronic circuit inside, which is measuring the noise of the environment. It's measuring the signal that's coming down the cable that's supposed to go to the earphones, and it's trying to create its own signal, an additional signal with amplification that cancels noise. If you're using the Bose stereo noise-canceling headset, that's a very delicate circuit that could be RF-sensitive. So when you go to those higher frequencies, your electronics with your noise-canceling circuit could be picking up. And I think you've got an on-off switch in there where you can turn off the noise-canceling function and also try another set of earphones that don't have noise-canceling. You could be picking up RF that's disturbing the circuit of the noise-canceling of those Bose headsets. I wonder if that's what's going on. Is that a possibility, Bob? W2PNJ, K2RIW, fun problem.
No, negative. It's the standard Bose headphones. They're not the noise canceling. I think they cost me about $130 before tax. Would magnets or wrapping it around it or, you know, anything like that help to try and prove it?
Yeah, George has had a great suggestion. Have you ever put the radio into a dummy load and repeated the process? Or did you already say you did that? Back to you, Bob.
No, I have not tried that yet.
That's worth a try. When you put a radio into a dummy load, hopefully it's very well shielded. See, when you're on 15, 17, and 10 meters and so on, you're radiating a real signal. And by some method of all worlds, the wiring of the earphones is a perfectly shielded coax cable, and there's a double wire going down the center with a stereo signal that goes to the two individual earphones. Well, the wiring of the earphones constitutes an antenna. It could be picking up RF signal. Even if the earphones themselves are nothing but a purely passive electromagnet, and though for that magnet to pick up the signal, that's awful doubtful. But the wire of your earphones could be an antenna shoving the signal back into the front panel, into the earphone connector, and then that does something funny inside. So if you try another brand of earphones, and if you try your radio into a dummy load, I think there's a high probability you're going to get a change in performance that's going to give you some more clues. Is that what you had in mind, George, when you suggested that you go into a dummy load? W2EMB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm at K2KY.
Mel recognized. George first. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was the idea, is that the radio amplifier, and you have, you know, like 10 feet of speaker wire to each speaker in the corner of your room, makes a great dipole to pick up, like, you know, 20 meters, 15 and up. I get a lot of that gobbledygook coming out of the stereo when the thing is not even on. And it's a little scary to some people who don't know what that is when all of a sudden you get this funny stuff coming out of the radio, and the radio's not even turned on. And when you get back to me, I have the transistor NEC information. Got it, Dick.
Very fine. So it's an NEC transistor, another good, very, very good brand name. Mel? Tell Bob what he'd like to know. You got it, Mel?
Now, I have had some problem with this problem. It's not exactly the way you presented it. And what I found the best way, I put these little ferrite chokes on the line, on the speaker lines, as the gentleman just before mentioned. And that seems to take that strange noise and some of us in here on the speakers without actually anything going through. The fact that you just get on the air, and sometimes the everybody always tell me, just, you know, I can hear you a little bit on the speakers, the stereo system, even when it's off. So I stuck these, I believe they call them common mode ferrite chokes. They just snap on. Where can I get them from? Remember, I thought maybe I bought it in the Radio Shack. Yeah, it could be possibly I bought it in the Radio Shack. Takes care of that problem almost immediately, Dick, without any sweat, as they say, over.
Yeah, I think that's a standard Radio Shack product, these little clamshells, ferrite things that you can buy that you clamp around a piece of wire and or wrap it a few times in there before clamping it down, and it presents a beautiful RF choke. What a lot of people don't know is that many hi-fi systems, many of the speakers that work with your computer and so on, have an internal power supply that's continuously powered even though it's not turned on. You think you turn the on-off switch off, but there's still 110 volts going to it. The power supply is still active. In the case of my television set, for instance, there was a power supply turned on all the time. Obvious by the fact I can pick up the remote control and press the button on it. It sends an infrared or a radio signal to the television set, which supposedly is turned off, and the television set comes alive. Obviously, there's a power supply running there. or in many cases, that power supply is also running the audio system. So you can have a hi-fi, a TV, or a set of speakers for your computer, which you think are turned off, but a citizen band operator, a police, or a taxi cab, paging service, a ham radio operator, whatever, somebody starts transmitting in the neighborhood, and his voice or a distorted version of it starts coming out of your loudspeakers. And people wonder, how in the world can audio be coming out of loudspeakers of an electronic chunk system that's turned off? Well, you think it's turned off. The word turned off is relative. And the active audio amplification stages can still be there. They can still rectify that RF, particularly if you provided a beautiful antenna like George and Mel have been indicating to us, the wire that's many feet long that goes to the loudspeakers, that goes to the earphones or whatever. And you think it's a piece of wire coupling audio. As far as the RF is concerned, it's a beautiful antenna picking up that signal, shoving it back into the front panel of the chunk of electronics in question. It eventually gets into the audio amplification stage and eventually comes back out as audio. It enters as RF into that wire, it comes back out as audio, and out of the loudspeakers it comes and you start hearing it and you think you're hearing a ghost, but you sort of see what's going on. So you've got a beautiful mystery there, Bob. I do recommend you try the RF choke, the dummy load, coiling the cable. If you coil the cable coming out of the radio before it goes to your earphones, that acts as a poor man's RF choke, and that could change the distortion you're hearing. So you've got three or four experiments you could do. We're sitting on the edge of our chair, waiting for you to come back later on tonight or next week, Bob, and tell us what any of these experiments indicate. Bob, for any further comments, W2TNJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Rick. The simplest thing for me is to go to Radio Shack and get some of those magnets. Because I don't have a dummy load to handle that size, the 100 watts. The cord of the line coming out of the earphones is like 6 foot long, and it's very, very tiny. It looks like zip cord. You got to handle it very delicate because it's not substantial at all. So I do suspect that it is picking up some RF and it's distorting the audio. Because the speaker is perfect on all bands, all frequencies. The audio from the fellow hams across the country, it sounds great, But on these earphones, they just go higher the frequency, the more the distortion. So I'll definitely try that. Thanks so much for your help. W2PNJ on the
comment. EO recognized. And Bob, there's an experiment you could do and you can report back to us tonight. And that is, even though that wire is delicate, you could wrap it around something that's convenient, like your can of spray, so to speak. You wrap that wire around the can, which is a poor man's RF choke, and then bring it to the earphones and plug it in so that most of the wire is in the coil, so to speak, as opposed to out flat. And then go back on 10 meters, and there's a good chance, I think, you're going to hear a difference in the distortion. And so even that as a poor man's RF choke would be an interesting experiment. Let's see what Richard's got to say. N2EO. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the K2RIW TechNet, one mark in Toledo. I own some 10-deck here, not the Orion 2, but the Orion 2 has an interesting thing that may be giving them trouble. The synthesized form of stereo, in other words, when you're listening to like a signal in the sideband or CW, as you go up the band, the sound goes from the left earpiece to the right earpiece, sort of like a pseudo stereo. And as you go down frequency, it shifts from the right earpiece to the left earpiece. Kind of unique for 10-deck. Possibly there's some type of stereo decoder in there, I don't know. In those headphones that may be giving him a problem, Dick.
Give us a couple more words on that, Rich. Why did 10-tech do that? Why is the CW side tone, in other words, when it's transmitting his CQ, why would it shift from left earphone to right earphone as a function of which band you're on? Is that because if you're in the heavy heat of battle of a contest, and your cue is flying between bands, it's a way of telling you, the listener, which band you're really on while you're transmitting? Is that what it's intended to do? Back to you, Rich.
No, it's more intended on receive, Dick. If you're listening to a CW on the Orion 2, it'll come out of both headphones, the left and right headphones. if you go down in frequency, in other words, turn the dial down while you're listening, it'll shift over from the right to the left side, indicating that you're over to the right side. Maybe he's got to be using sometimes stereo headphones to do that. Now that function, I believe, only works on headphones, not on the speaker. Because there's one speaker. I don't believe they use two speakers on the Orion 2. So it may be that circuitry, when he engages the headphones, that's giving him the problem. He may want to give a call to Pentec. They're very, very good. If he calls Pentec, he'll probably get one of the engineers that works on the radio. I had a little problem with my Jupiter, and they solved it in about 10 minutes.
Very interesting. That's a unique function. That's cute. So as you dial down, it goes to the left, telling you you're moving, the queue is winding down. How about that? That's a nice feedback system. Okay, let's see. We had questions from Rich, Bob, both Gordon and the second Bob, MWA. Both of them had no further questions. I think we've covered everyone who signed in, and I'm going to give a quick list now to be sure, and if that's true, then we'll go over to Mel's lesson number 3 on the Swiss chart. So did we cover everyone who signed in? KQLAW on the break now.
Okay, so you have to be a quick comment.
Go right ahead, Bob. I knew you'd have a comment. You got it.
Okay, I just wanted to let everybody know that I did get the 6-meter beam up, so it's ready to run. As soon as we get an opening on 6, I'll find out how well it works.
You don't even need an opening to talk to Jay, KQOBS, out there in Laurel on the North Fork of Long Island. He's a 6-meter operator from way back, and so he can choose the right hour that he's on the air. And there's also quite a number of guys both in Connecticut and New Jersey, which you should have no trouble getting to them on Groundwave. So you don't even need a band opening. So by Groundwave, you're going to be talking to people. Worst comes to worst, I'm pretty sure Jay is listed in the phone book. He's heavily involved in the Peconic Amateur Radio Club. If you simply Google Peconic Amateur Radio Club, I think he's the vice president these days. He has a net you could sign into, which I believe meets on Wednesday night, but I'm not sure. It may have moved to Thursday. So one way or another, you're going to be talking to people on Groundwave. I wonder if you've done any listening on the band. I hope you've at least heard some of the local power line noise and 60 cycle noise. Let's see, what other kind of birdies do you hear on 6 meters? I guess occasionally you hear television sets and all kinds of things. Hopefully you're hearing some of these noises when you have the noise blanker turned off, giving you indication that your transmission line is connected and the antenna is alive and well. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, KCQMWA again. There is a beacon over in somewhere in Bergen County in New Jersey, and that's usually what I use to check the antenna out.
With the main lobe, reasonable level of the side lobe. And by the way, one of the well-kept secrets, and I've been writing a series of articles on the microwave reflector on the subject lately. I also have some articles that are being printed by a VHF magazine in Australia on the subject of side-low levels. When you tune a Yagi for the highest possible gain for that particular length of Yagi, one of the world's best-kept secrets is that when the gain is maximized, the first side lobe level will be 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe will be 22.5 dB down. The third side lobe will be 29 dB down. The reason I'm so, with such emphasis, saying will be is that you can definitely retune a Yagi to make those first side lobes stronger or weaker. In either case, you will sacrifice gain, you'll sacrifice beamwidth. When the Yagi is tuned for best possible performance, the Yagi is presenting a near-circular effective capture area. In other words, the aperture of the antenna. If your eyes operated at that frequency of that Yagi, and you look down the throat of the Yagi, you would see a black circle, which has got the right diameter for the right area, and gain equals area. You tell me what the gain of the antenna is and what wavelength you're working on, and I can tell you exactly what the diameter and the area of the capture of that antenna is. And if your eyes operate at those frequencies, you look down the antenna, you would see a black hole in space at that diameter, all the RF energy going into that black hole, down your transmission line, and peg the S meter, so to speak. So, once you have a circular aperture, with uniform distribution of energy across the aperture when you're transmitting. Once you have a circular aperture with a uniform distribution, at the highest gain you're ever going to get out of a dish, a horn, a gaggy, whatever, it will have those exact side lobes level. That's basic math. You got Mr. Seebeck, C-E-C-Beck, W4, I can't remember his call letters now, RNL or something like that. He's got 100 pages he's published on his computer modeling of the IDs where he has tweaked and tweaked and tweaked, and he's trying to make the side lobes 25 and 30 feet down, all side lobes that far down. And he thinks he's doing something good, because common sense would lead you to believe that the energy in those side lobes you think is wasted energy. It is not. And you think it's sacrificing your main lobe efficiency and your overall aperture efficiency. It is not. That Yagi has what an optical astronomer will call an airy disk, a diffraction-limited optical telescope, which in most cases is a round mirror with near uniform aperture distribution. It will have the first side lobe, second side lobe, and third side lobe of the airy disk. The rings of that picture you get out of that optical telescope will be that number of dB down. So, in your case, with your Yagi, it would be nice to switch it back and forth and measure the amplitude of those side lobes if the signal you're listening to is strong enough. But that little piece of information I just gave you, boy, that's a well-kept secret. I haven't read it in any respected book, ham radio-wise, physics-wise, the antenna manuals. You can go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek and Johnson. You can go to Krauss's book on antennas. You can go to any of the respected manuals. None of them make that phenomena clear. I'm kind of amazed that that's such a well-kept secret. So there is a desired level of side lobes to get maximum performance out of these antennas. Now, every parabolic dish antenna you've ever used has side lobes that are considerably weaker than that for a very good reason. The very best horn that you can buy to illuminate that dish has a pattern that's not ideal. It's the best pattern you're going to get out of that size horn. And as such, the horn usually is adjusted for a 10 dB amplitude taper. That means the edge of your parabolic dish is going to be getting a signal when you transmit 10 dB weaker than the center of the dish. That's the best you can get with the horn performance. And therefore, the side lobes of that antenna are further down than these numbers I gave you, 17.5, 22, and 29. But that doesn't mean that you're getting the best efficiency out of that dish. A good parabolic dish antenna with that as a horn gives you 55 to 65% efficiency. That's where it's coming from. You're not evenly illuminating the dish. You're not using the perimeter of the dish with equal amplitude as you are in the center of the dish. If you had a horn that could do that, you'd get 100% efficiency out of the dish. But the horn with that much control of its primary pattern, where it evenly squeezes the power evenly across the dish and then abruptly falls to zero at the perimeter, that much control would be a cluster feed phased array horn system with about 1,000 individual horns with exactly the right amplitude and phase of all of those horns. The horn would be 30 wavelengths in diameter, the horn cluster feed system, to have that much control in the primary pattern. Well, since most of our parabolic dish antennas are only 10 or 20 wavelengths in diameter, to have a 30 wavelength diameter horn is crazy. The horn would have more gain, horns than we can realize, have to have a 10 dB taper, and the side lobes are further down. And that confuses people, because their dish has side lobes further down, they think they should tune their Yagi the same way. You're going to be sacrificing performance if you do. I know this is a little bit complicated, but I wonder if it made some sense. Back to you, Bob. I wonder if you had a chance yet to look at the pattern a little bit.
Jay?
We'll get to you in a second, then, Mr. PNG, I think it is. Mr. FWA, go right ahead, Bob.
Okay, well, Dick, I really haven't done much with, you know, figuring out what the exact pattern of this thing looks like. I do know this much from a quick experiment I ran this afternoon with somebody, that the side rejection is extremely good, which is, now makes it even better. So you're only listening to what you got it aimed at primarily.
Good sign. I think it was Mr. PNJ. Bob, Bob number one, go right ahead.
Okay, you solved the problem, Dick. I wrapped it around a piece of cardboard tube, and I completely eliminated the distortion. Stretched it out, you know, took it off the tube, of course, and then I stretched it out and the distortion came back. The only problem was my favorite My face was about 12 inches from the front of the receiver.
Fantastic. Okay. That's a success story, Bob.
Wow.
That ticket for you and your lady friend to the real fine restaurant that that Mel was going to mail you, we don't have to. You've gotten your pay. Hey, Mel, you've been relieved from the responsibility. He got his money's worth tonight. Thank you. We're having fun with you, Bob. Okay, I think we've answered all the questions of people who signed it. Let me double check and make sure. KQLIW listening.
And
Julio
with a quick request.
WB2HWW.
Okay, I heard it double that time between, I think, George second and EO first. Rich, go right ahead.
HWW.
Howie also. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick. Yeah, you got Howie in there, so pick him up. I know there's a lot of people listening, and I'm looking for a ride to the holiday party this year. I don't know how many people are aware, but I had to cancel my hip surgery. I was supposed to go to get a replacement right hip, and my father took sick. We have a hospice coming in the house. He has lung cancer. He never smoked. And the only thing is, his brother died from it. He never smoked. And my father did work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard during World War II, where there was asbestos all over the place. But be that as it may, I'd like to get out, and I'm looking for a ride to the holiday party. I'm only driving locally right now. I don't want to negotiate the parkway because of the disability with the right leg. I have to drive with 2 feet, one on the gas, one on the brake, and I really don't want to get out on the parkway that way. So if anybody is coming from the Whitestone, Queens area, about a mile south of the Florence Neck Bridge, I would like to get a ride out to the holiday party in Plymouth. Back to that in 2 weeks. Pick up Howie and pick up the other station, Dick.
Okay, that's a reasonable request, Rich. If a person wants to offer a ride to you from Whitestone, a mile south of the Florence Neck Bridge, what's the easiest way they can get a hold of you? I guess one way is you're on the air quite a few hours per day, and they'll eventually hear you on this particular frequency. Is there another way a person who wants to offer you a ride can get a hold of you, Rich?
Yeah, Dick, I'll give out my phone number. I don't mind because I've got caller ID on there. It's 718-352-4867. 718-352-4867.
And in 2EO at ARWorld.net. Okay, let's hope you get a ride for the holiday party. Next person who signed in was George, W2ENV. Go ahead with your comment.
Okay, W2ENV. I was going to tell the fellow with the headphone problem, in way back in the old days, you could wrap aluminum foil around it about a 6-inch length and slide it up and down on the wire, and that may, short out the RF. You should do that on the old twin lead dipole antennas for TV in the old days. The other comment I wanted to make, Dick, was this super low noise device is a pseudomorphic heterojunction silicon doped aluminum gallium arsenide and undoped, I don't know what IN stands for, Ignatius something gallium arsenide to create very high mobility electrons. How do you like that? It's an NE3210 in an SO1 package. 3.5 dB noise figure at 12 gigahertz and about 13.5 dB of... This is the MGF series.
Nice. Indium arsenide, gallium arsenide, semiconductor. You go on and on and on with the technology that goes into these things. It just goes on forever, George. These transistors. What they're trying to tell you, George, is this fancy goop inside of that box with three or four leads coming out of there. You got to treat that fancy goop with tender loving care. You got to pray to it periodically, and you got to make sure you obey all the electronic ESD, electrostatic discharge characteristics. The more sensitive they are to low noise figure at high frequencies, the more the ESD sensitive. That's the rub. But as long as you're willing to live with that particular characteristic, they're fantastic. You got to be a little bit careful when it comes to a line driving preamplifier. right up at the antenna. You want to make sure your relay flips first before your transmitter goes on, so you're not roaring any of the transmitter in the back end of the preamp. Second of all, most of the guys will try to make sure that when their ham radio equipment is turned off, that the relay up at the antenna is in the transmit mode to make sure that any lightning or whatever coming down the antenna doesn't get to your genset. Gensets have got some very mysterious failures that occur when they're a line driving preamplifier up at the top of the tower on the antenna. In fact, some guys go through all the extra effort of running their coax cable and control line up the center of the tower, not on the outside of the tower, so the tower becomes a coaxial shield to the lightning pickup in the area, so they don't get any electromagnetic pulse being picked up by that wiring when lightning occurs. Lightning almost never strikes your tower. It's almost always going to strike the nearby 110-volt power line system because it's a much bigger target. But the local EMP that creates gets picked up by the wiring and eventually creates failures of the gensets preamp. The preamp itself, you want to make sure it's in a well-shielded box. It's got all kinds of bypassing. Some guys will back it up with back-to-back zener diodes on the E-plus input to be sure that that doesn't get an impulse. And so all kinds of heroic things are required to make sure that your line driving preamplifier up at the antenna on the tower doesn't get wiped out mysteriously. And either that, they'll be willing to climb the tower rather frequently every time you have to repair it or replace it. The good news is you get the best possible noise figure when you do that. The bad news is it's a fairly vulnerable environment. You've got to be careful. Good luck with that project and let us know how that works out. Howie, go right ahead with your comment. KQL at W Protect Man.
Alright,
yes.
When we were talking about antennas for
HG, what's your favorite on that one, Howie?
On the second one, I'm for HG. This one on the 10 is the only band with a rubber duck that I get electrical shots. I found the
point. Well, you told us what band it is, and repeat that one, Howie.
14-inch rubber duck. And you hear them. First, you
want
to close to the top of the, the antenna, you get an RF
current. 10 meters, Dick. Howie has a Motorola radio with a quarter wave, rubber duck antenna. I got the same radio. It's a Motorola commercial job.
Interesting. So when you put your hand near the top of the rubber duck on 10 meters, you're saying you sense some high power RF current. Is that what you're saying, Rich, Ben?
Yeah, that's to me, but it's not to Howard. He's mentioned that a number of times. Howard has a repeater on 10 meters, linked to the 440 machine, and we're both using the same radio. What is it called now? It's not an MT-1000. What do we got? Can't remember the model number of the radio we got. But it's in the radius line, and the rubber duck comes with a cutting shot, depending on the frequency. And it just takes 30 megacycles the full length, which is kind of a foot long, I guess. So basically, when you get this radio, you don't cut it. You put a little plastic cap on and just leave it full length. And it just makes it down to like 29 megacycles. But yeah, Howard has mentioned getting RF burns. The radio puts out about 5 or 6 watts, Dick.
Very nice. Now, when you're on 10 meters with that rubber duck on that handy talkie, and you think the RF energy is being radiated by that rubber duck, I bet you 30% of the RF energy is being radiated by your hand, your wrist, your arm, your elbow, and the rest of your humerus bone is doing 30% of the radiation. So, is it a 5/8 wave antenna, quarter wave antenna, half wave antenna? The answer is yes to all of the above. It's a fun project. You'd be amazed how many times a person says, hey, that's the antenna. Well, and you think it's the rest of it, not the antenna. You build yourself an end-fed step or an offset or a Windom antenna, and you think that the wire that you put up there that you call antenna, you think all the radiation is coming from that. There's a lot of radiation coming from the rest of the transmission line in some of those examples. So where is the antenna? Reminds me of the PBS program, where is, I can't remember the name of the town guy, some little character. Okay. I think we're ready now for Mel's third installment on the Smith chart. And so, Professor Mel, you've got the floor. We've got our Smith chart in front of us. We've got our ruler. We've got our compass. We're ready to draw. We're ready to listen. And this is a credit-giving course. When you can prove that you've taken all three or four sessions from Mel, you get a certificate, and the certificate's going to make you well-respected and rich and well-informed about RS. K2KUI. KQI, W in the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KUI. Actually, this is number four. We have had some nice emails. People have made copies of the previous three lessons. What they do then, they get substituted in their numbers, their measurements, and basically able to use the chart. And the one particular one mentioned, he says, thank you for going step by step and explaining how and why you put the points and how you mathematically come up with a number of the different steps. That'd be appreciated. We never see that mentioned before in any of the magazines. They take too much, he says, for granted that we understand everything. Now, as far as one, I'm just going to give one quick, funny little comment, then we'll all have a laugh, and then we'll get on with something serious. The distance of the yard that we know is 36 inches, was arrived when they had King George stretch his arm out, and they measured from the tip of his nose to the tip of his finger. Now, I ask you, isn't that the best way to have a scientific measurement stick, rather than have something in a vacuum or a piece of some exotic piece of metal? I think that's the most best way, is measured from his tip of his nose to the tip of his finger. I can't see why we even would think of doing away with that. Over.
Well, that's a beautiful system, Mel. But I think it goes from his nose when he's looking straight forward to his arm outstretched to the far right-hand side, and I believe it was the base of his thumb. I think they made the measurement from the tip of his nose to the base of his thumb of that particular king who reigned at that particular time. And assuming now that you're using that length with your arm to stretch out length of yarn, because you've got this great big ball of wool, and you want to know how many yards of wool you've got, it's a perfectly good measurement system. And I guess you could also use it for measuring your coax cable. But I wouldn't trust it to more than an inch or two of accuracy out of 36 inches. And there's the problem. Because nowadays, our calculators are giving us 12 decimals of accuracy in the straight mode. In the high precision mode, they're giving 20 or 24 decimals of accuracy. And so, we like to do things a little bit more scientifically these days, and therefore, that may not be a good standard. Reminds me also of the, somebody wrote a standard once, tongue-in-cheek, into Electronic Design News magazine, in which he wanted the standard unit of sound to be the bleep that is given out by a lamb when that lamb is looking across the wind, a river, and the lamb is looking at a standard female lamb who's in heat, and he gives off a particular sound, and so that was going to be the standard sound level, a bleep, and that lamb was going to be kept in a lean-to garage alongside of the standard, the National Bureau of Standards, and that was going to be the standard for sound level. And you can go on and on with these things. You can have a lot of fun with them. What do you use as a standard? So back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Is it a right-handed yarn or a left-handed yarn?
That's darn good. And are you telling us a real tall yarn here, George? Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, well, in fact, I'll tell you, I measured off a piece of coax cable by that method, and then I used the TDR, and I think the TDR is inaccurate, Dick.
No, well, but because your thumb is just the right length from your nose, and you equal the length of the king, because you're a kingly-like guy, obviously you've got to recalibrate your time domain reflectometer, your MFJ-TDR. You found its inaccuracy, you're traceable to the Bureau, so therefore you reset it, and everything became hunky-dory after that. Is that true, Mel?
Well, it has to be an AEA-TDR. I wouldn't use, you know, something cheaper. I've got to use a top-notch instrument and prove that, yes, even that's wrong, over.
Okay, I'm glad you got that straight. So now your whole lab is properly calibrated.
Exactly, that's how we do things. The heck with all this business, exotic metals, vacuum changes, and all that stuff. This is traceable to the WKEY method. if you believe that, I'll sell you the bridge too. I have that up for sale, the bridge. I now you think I'm going to get rid of that thing instead of painting, you know, what, like painting it. Anyway, as far as I'll get back to something that makes sense here a little bit, hopefully, as far as this chart, coax cable and everything as we were just discussing, up to now we've been more or less working with matching and coaxial cable, where we've actually assumed the cable is fairly lossless. We can almost assume today that any decent main piece of cable operating the HF portion of the amateur radio bin is going to be a pretty good piece of wire to get from our Radio Shack to our antenna, and in most cases, most of the hands, less than 100 feet of wire, so of cable, so I don't think it's really, you know, much worry about HF, about loss. However, when we start to get up here, 2 meters and above, things start to change somewhat. And now we have to think about this cable again, that we volume cable that seems to be great, that we picked up at a ham test, and how good or bad it is. Now there's another support operating here from 2 meters, maybe 70 centimeters, etc. And so, I made a little example of using the Smith chart to really to plot the loss on a piece of cable. Anybody have any questions before we proceed? Okay, not here's what I did. I took a length of just a piece of scrap cable I had, and just for argument's sake and for the sake of illustration and everything, I took the piece of cable and I measured it. Now, I'm going to work in metrics because I'll show you how basically it's simple right now to work in metrics. The piece of cable I took, happened to be a scrap piece, was 24 centimeters long. I measured it, I terminated, and I measured it, and I have, and this I may try to make things come out somewhat even so you can follow it easier, so we won't get a lot of complicated math. And it measured. It's terminated with 10 minus J10 ohms. Okay, so normalizing that measurement, dividing it by 50, like we've done in the past few weeks, we'll get 0.2 equals minus, or I should say 0.2 minus J0.2. Now, if we locate that spot on our Smith chart, you'll see go along the 0.2, the resistance, that circle, resistance circle comes off the center axis, go down, and to our reactance, scale on the edge, 0.2, and the two of them come together, make a dot, and we'll call that dot B for boy. Any questions? Okay? The next thing we're going to do now, we measure the piece of cable, and we put it aside for a minute, and here's what we're going to do next. First of all, we're going to find, as we're going to test the piece of cable, I should have mentioned this first, that we're going to test the piece of cable, as I said, we're going to try it. We're going to test the piece of cable at higher frequency. So I picked out a spot that just happens to be convenient for me. And I said between 2 meters and 70 centimeters someplace, so I said, okay, arbitrarily I picked out 250 megahertz. Now, we are going first to find what is the electrical length of a piece of wire, a piece of coax cable, a piece of line at 250 megahertz. And how do we do that? Well, as Dick had said earlier, take 300,000 or 300 times 10 to the 6th power, and we divide it by 250 megahertz or 250 times 10 to the 6th power. And that'll equal 1.2 meters. That's how we determine that. That frequency, that length is 1.2 meters, or 120 centimeters, or 47 inches. I think I more or less got it all right mathematically, converting from one to the other, using 2.54 as 1 inch. Any questions so far?
What about the velocity factor?
Velocity factor is factors that we get with the cable. We're not going to worry so much about the velocity factor because we're using a very short piece of cable at this point.
Because it's not the electrical line, we have to figure in the velocity factor.
Well, he's measuring He knows whether he's measuring the physical length or the electrical length. By the way, 10 minus J10 input impedance. If we went through the calculation, I can do that later on. There's ways he's going to show you how the slip chart can do it. It's a 5.2 VISWAM, which is a reflection coefficient of 3.38 dB, and the signal has been down the end of the cable and back, so therefore one way is 1.69. He's got 1.69 dB of apparent loss, but we'll get into those things later. You got it, Mel?
No, actually, I calculated it to 2 dB, probably 2 dB loss. Well, like I say, I wanted to keep it simple, please. You know, that they get emails that they lost us. So, all right, we just determined that this is a piece of wire, a piece of cable at this frequency of 250 megahertz would be 1.2 meters, or, again, 120 centimeters. Now, if we want to, what we do, we want to now find that this piece of cable that we're using as our test piece of cable, what is its electrical length in reference to this determination we just did previously. So what we're going to do, we're going to divide 24 centimeters by 120 centimeters, and we're going to see its 0.2 wavelength, 0.2 wavelength. Now, if we multiply it by 360 degrees, we'll see it's 72 degrees. So this is the electrical length. I hope I didn't have any questions. Okay, no questions. Okay, so the first thing we do, the point that we have, point B, on the fifth chart, from the center of the chart, where it's 1.0, we're going to draw a straight line right through the edge of the chart, right through point B. Okay, next we're going to take now, I said the electrical length now, this piece is 72 degrees. We're going to look on the edge of the chart, and we're going to see approximately around 72 degrees. At that point, we're going to go from that point, we're going to make a little mark there, 72 degrees, take your straight edge now, and make a line straight through that, right to the center, the 1.0 center, straight line. We'll call that line A. Any questions? Okay, next thing we're going to do now, on this line here, this line A, this line A actually, because of the way we did the computation, that somewhere on this line we're going to find a lossless spot, and we're also going to be able to display also a lossy spot. Both will display on this line because this is actually the mathematical equivalent of this at this frequency, the length. What do we do now to find out what's going on? We take our compass, the pin of your compass on 1.0, the pencil on point B, and we swing an arc all the way around, going through line A, right down to the center of the axis, right to where it touches the axis. And where it crosses line A, we will call that point C now. With this circle we just made, this radius we just made, we'll call that point C where it crosses line A. Any questions? Okay, next thing we're going to do now, we're going to drop where this circle that we made, that went around and is touching now the center axis. We're going to drop a perpendicular straight down right through the chart into the, what says, radically scaled parameters, four steps, down on the bottom. And we're going to see that we are approximately towards the generator, we're going to read. And you see that the dB loss, now you notice this, the attenuation is dB. Notice that it is approximately around 2 dB. Now what we do, we want to transfer this now and see what it actually looks like on the chart itself. Take your compass, put it on the edge of the line there, where right at the very edge where that line comes on its parallel to it. Oh, compass, dB, reading, take, and put the pin of the compass again on 1.0, and swing the small, just a small up through low, and make that point D. D, any questions? Okay, now, we can easily read now. Now, the point C that we had originally, we can now read that, and that will give us 0.71 approximately. It's all approximate. It doesn't have to be precise. 0.71 plus J1.52. That would reckon that would be actually our supposedly lossless point. The lossless point of a piece of cable at that frequency if we've had a piece that's lost. If we look at point D and we read that, it's 1.08 approximately plus J1.05. That's our lossy spot. Now we can unnormalize both of them if you want to compare the actual input pieces that you'll be reading, but if you look from C to point D, to give you an idea, visualize what a piece of cable is, this piece of cable that's got approximately around 2 dB loss will look like. Any questions? All right, so Dick, I don't know, did I make it sound right? I don't know what else. I think I sort of try to cover it as simply as possible, so maybe you can critique it a little bit more. Go ahead.
I agree with all of the above, and it's one of many ways of using a Smith chart. And I'm going to show you a slightly different way, a little bit more mathematical. I won't spend too much time on this, so if you don't like it, if you don't like the man, it'll go away in about 3 minutes, so bear with me. When Mel used his AEA impedance measuring device, and he got an answer of 10 ohms resistance and minus J10 of reactance. That really means he had 10 ohm resistive components and 10 ohms of capacitive reactance as an equivalent series circuit. And I write that down as open parentheses 10, comma, minus 10, close parentheses. That's the format in which my Hewlett Packard 28 likes to see a complex number. Complex number means one that's got a real and an imaginary part of it. That minus 10 is the imaginary part, which really represents the capacitance. Once you know that impedance, you can always figure out what is the reflection coefficient, and what is the standing wave ratio, and what is the insertion loss, by doing the following. You take that complex number, 10 minus 10, 10 minus J10, and you subtract 50 ohms from it, which really means the minus 10 is going to become minus 40, divided by that exact same complex number with 50 ohms added. So let me call the impedance 10 minus 10 as Z measured. So if I take Z minus 50 ohms divided by Z plus 50 ohms, I end up with a bunch of gobbledygook. Actually carry out that division, which just means you hit the divide sign on a Hewlett-Packard calculator. If you're real skilled with the calculations, you can really normalize the top and the bottom by converting it into a plus and minus number, so to speak, and you end up with an answer. But you end up with an absolute value after you do that division. That absolute value, you can then take the log of that absolute value, multiply it by 20, and you'll end up with a 3.38 decibels. That really means the reflection coefficient is 3.38 decibels of the 10 minus 10 that he gave us. In other words, the signal going down the cable, hitting either an open circuit or a short circuit at the far end, and the signal can't be absorbed because it's an open or a short, and won't absorb any energy. Therefore, the signal reflects back. The signal came back 3.38 dB down. That's his reflection coefficient. Since you know the signal has been down his cable twice, divide that by 2, you get 1.69 dB. In other words, with two decimal places of accuracy, his 10 minus 10 number is telling us that he's got one
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm not quite sure what happened, but as I said, we measured a reflection coefficient of 3.38 dB, which magnitude-wise happened to equal